This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the March 13, 2019 edition of Takes on the World, a program in international affairs that comes your way every second and fourth Wednesday and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. 8 years ago, nationally known New York Times columnist Tom Friedman wrote of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, quote, that the standing ovation he got in Congress this year was not for his politics. That ovation was bought and paid for by the Israel lobby, end quote. Friedman was referring to Netanyahu's speech on March 24, 2011, to a joint session of Congress while he was in Washington for an annual convention of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's main lobby in the U.S. During that speech, Netanyahu received not one but 29 standing ovations, and they came just 3 days after the Israeli Prime Minister had dressed down President Obama like an errant schoolboy at a White House press conference. The Congress's response to Netanyahu so astonished the world-renowned Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, who was in Washington a few weeks later to speak at a conference critical of the Israel lobby, that he declared this to be, quote, the United States of Israel. It would be one of two such sessions of the House and Senate that Netanyahu would address during Obama's term of office, the second coming in 2015, in which he railed against the White House efforts to forge an agreement with Iran to curtail its nuclear enrichment program in exchange for lifting U.S. sanctions, which AIPAC strongly opposed. In that instance, publicly boycotted by 60 Democrats, he received only 25 standing ovations. While AIPAC was unable to prevent the agreement with Iran from being signed and going into effect, it was able to get legislation passed that would allow the next president, in this case Donald Trump, to break the deal, which is promised he did. While Friedman's comment in 2011, as could be expected, was assailed by some members of Congress and criticized by tax-exempt Jewish organizations whose primary activity is propagandizing for Israel, it was nothing like what has been experienced by Ilhan Omar, the young Muslim woman from Somalia and newly elected representative from Minnesota, who essentially said the same thing as Friedman, has been subject to nonstop attack and disparaging comments from the mainstream and Jewish media, including NPR, who Steve Inskeep just yesterday morning kept badgering another new young black congresswoman from Illinois, Lauren Underwood, to comment on Omar's remarks, despite her clearly stated desire not to do so. And from this coming March 24th through the 26th, AIPAC will again hold this convention in Washington with 18,000, mostly members, expected to attend. Netanyahu, under the threat of indictment for corruption at home and facing a difficult re-election on April 7th, will be a featured guest meeting with and looking for selfies with warm words from Trump, who is more popular in Israel than he is, and recently added to the AIPAC agenda was his chief rival, former General Benny Gantz. If passed as prologue, several thousand student leaders from universities and colleges around the country will be there as guests, and at least half the members of Congress, including the leaders of both parties, and if not President Trump, Vice President Mike Pence. The members of Congress will have their names slowly read from the podium as if they were on an honor roll, letting would-be donors in the audience know who should be on the receiving end of their checks come 2020 elections. You never read or hear a word in the mainstream media, nor in NPR, about these AIPAC conferences and the pledges of devotion to Israel by our country's leaders, despite their being available on C-SPAN. Whether the controversy over Omar's remarks about our politicians who support a foreign government in which she never mentioned Jews by name, nor the term dual loyalty, and the fumbled attempt by Nancy Pelosi to get a resolution passed in the House condemning anti-Semitism, will spur the media and NPR to report on this year's conference remains to be seen. To give you an idea of what you've been missing, in a very few minutes, I'm going to play you the speech made by Senator Kamala Harris to AIPAC in 2017, just after she was elected to the Senate, but apparently already had presidential aspirations. This will be followed by a speech at last year's convention by Nikki Haley, who was then our ambassador to the UN and who, like Harris, now prominent in the Democratic field for 2020, may be the Republicans' presidential nominee in 2024 or possibly next year if Trump, for one reason or another, is not in the running for a second term. So stay tuned for that. It can be argued that the very existence of AIPAC and the presence of half of Congress at its annual convention is prima facie evidence that whatever one may say of Ilhan Omar's choice of language, and I have no problem with it, that what M4 is saying is simply the truth, one that has long been acknowledged in congressional cloakrooms but not spoken aloud in public. While technically AIPAC itself doesn't contribute directly to members of Congress, as she alluded, it does provide guidance to would-be donors about which pro-Israel members of Congress or candidates are the neediest. In addition, its board members contribute as individuals, while others head some of the several dozen political action committees or PACs whose sole criteria for contributing to a candidate is their support for Israel. The names of the PACs are disguised to prevent the general public from knowing what they're up to, namely putting the interest of Israel before that of the United States. They have been around for years and have come to be called what they are, stealth PACs, and thanks to Ilhan Omar raising the issue, they were actually mentioned in a rare New York Times article on March 4th by Cheryl Gay Stolberg, headlined, "Ilhan Omar's criticism raises the question, is AIPAC too powerful?" Who would suspect from their name is the motives of the Florida Congressional Committee, NORPAC in New Jersey, to protect our heritage PAC outside Chicago, the Maryland Association for Concerned Citizens outside Baltimore, among others, that operate independently of AIPAC, as the New York Times article but points out, but those whose missions and membership align with it. Tom Dine, who urged local activists to create the regional PACs when he ran AIPAC from 1980 to 1993, notes the Times Stolberg, summed up his mantra for AIPAC members this way. To be pro-Israel, quote, is to be politically active. To be politically active is to give of your time, your brain power, and your wallet, end quote. It should be pointed out that the New York Times article concluded with an ominous comment by Stephen Fisk, an AIPAC member who heads the well-disguised Florida Congressional Committee. Fisk told the Times it was time for, quote, pro-Jewish voices to speak up about Ms. Omar and two other Democratic freshmen who have been critical of Israel, Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. And he offered a prediction, quote, they are three people who, in my opinion, will not be around in several years, end quote. Leading the attack on Omar in the House and pushing for resolution, condemning only anti-Semitism, were three Jewish members of Congress from New York, Elliot Engel, Nita Lowey, and Gerald Nadler, all of whom chair important congressional committees. Speaking at a luncheon symposium co-hosted by the American Zionist Movement and the World Zionist Organization on the eve of the midterm election, Engel promised that now as head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, he said, I will do what I have done in Congress for the past 30 years, quote, I will stand squarely with Israel, I will stand squarely with the Jewish people. I want to make sure, said Engel, that the alliance between Israel and the United States is so strong that it doesn't matter who is president or who is prime minister. What matters is the bond between the U.S. and Israel should be strengthened regardless of who gets elected as president at any particular election. I have spent 30 years in Congress, and I believe that there's no one in the entire Congress who supports Israel more than I do, said Engel. His comments, I suspect, are what Bacher Unger Sargon, the opinion editor of the Weekly Forward, the nation's oldest Jewish publication, had in mind when in the magazine's March issue she wrote critically of, quote, the blind fealty to Israel that has gradually replaced Jewish identity in America for the past 50 years, end quote. This has been less true of younger Jews in recent years as it had been for the Democratic Party as a whole, despite the millions of dollars that have been spent encouraging the affinity of Jewish teens to Israel through such programs as Birthright Israel, that brings young Jews to Israel in hopes they will consider Israel their homeland and become spokespersons for Israel when they return to the States. The sea change in the Democratic Party became apparent at the 2012 convention when Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, a strong supporter of Israel, overruled a clear voice vote from the delegates on the floor against including a plank endorsing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and the delegates roared the disapproval of his action. Since then, Israel's criminal actions against the Palestinians have been on full display on computer screens, beginning with its third war on Gaza in 2014, the effects of its crippling siege on the Strip's inhabitants, and for the past year, the videos of Israeli snipers gunning down nonviolent protesters at the Israel-Gaza border, as well as medics, small children, and journalists, which have gone viral and shocked young Democrats, Jews as well as non-Jews, While the party's leaders, beginning with Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer, have either justified Israel's crimes or ignored them. Schumer, it should be noted, is proud to tell Jewish audiences that his name Shomer in Hebrew means defender of the ghetto and now Israel. The midterm election that produced the victories of Ocasio-Cortez, Tlaib, and Omar, among others, has also led to an unprecedented resistance by members of the Congressional Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus to the demands of the party's hierarchy. This was amply demonstrated by their refusal to condemn Ilhan Omar or support a resolution that only considered anti-Semitism as Pelosi and condemned anti-Semitism as Pelosi and the Jewish House leadership demanded, pointing out that there has never been a resolution condemning the far more prevalent racist and violent acts in this country against people of color. Clearly, it has become increasingly evident that more and more young Democrats, and particularly those of color, have seen and had enough. Even Kamala Harris, whose speech you'll hear in a moment, has had some second thoughts from those she expressed to AIPAC in 2017 and again in an off-the-record interview before 3,000 students at last year's AIPAC get-together. Not only did Harris vote against the recent Senate bill making boycotting of Israel by business a crime, which is now already the law in California and 25 other states, but she refused to criticize Ilhan Omar when asked to comment. Like some of my colleagues in the Congressional Black Caucus, I am concerned that the spotlight being put on Congresswoman Omar may put her at risk, said Harris in a statement released last Wednesday. We should have a sound, respectful discussion about policy. We can both support Israel and be loyal to our country, the statement continued. I also believe there's a difference between criticism of policy or political leaders and anti-Semitism. Whether that will be good enough for AIPAC remains to be seen, but here now is Kamala Harris speaking to AIPAC in 2017.
Good morning, AIPAC. Good morning. What an honor. Lillian, congratulations on your outstanding presidency, and it's great to be with you again this year. I also want to thank AIPAC's Executive Director, Howard Kaur, and I'm just thrilled to see all of the students in the audience. In you, I see our future. I want to especially recognize the nearly 1,000 Californians who are here today. And of course, including my dear friends and AIPAC board members, Anita Friedman and Sissy Swig and Amy Friedkin. And I'm proud to say and be that among the many voices represented here, the California delegation is the largest and hopefully the loudest. There you go. So having grown up in the Bay Area, I fondly remember those Jewish National Fund boxes that we would use to collect donations to plant trees for Israel. Years later, when I visited Israel for the first time, I saw the fruits of that effort and the Israeli ingenuity that has truly made a desert bloom. I soaked in the sights and sounds and smells of Jerusalem. I stood in Yad Vashem, devastated by the silent testimonies of the 6 million Jews that were murdered in the Holocaust. And we must always remember that solemn promise, never again. And I did what I often do when visiting a new country. I visited the highest court in the land. And as I toured Israel's Supreme Court, I was struck by the iconic architecture, which embodies Israel's founding principles of democracy and rule of law. The design of that building left a lasting impression on me. Its straight lines, which represent the immutable nature of truth, while the curved walls and glass represent the fluid nature of tzedek, of justice. And this is a concept that is personal for me, because it's that same commitment to justice for the voiceless and the vulnerable that led my parents as students to march for civil rights in the 1960s while pushing me in a stroller. And it's why I became a prosecutor and personally prosecuted everything from low-level offenses to homicides. It's why I became San Francisco District Attorney and was later elected Attorney General of California, where I took on, thank you, where I took on transnational gangs, cyber criminals, and mortgage fraud. And that commitment to justice is why I ran to become a United States Senator from the great state of California. The point being to continue that fight. And a critical piece of my agenda is the fight to defend and strengthen our national security. As a member of both the Senate Intelligence Committee and Homeland Security Committee, I have a front row seat to these issues, and I am proud to stand strongly with America's allies, including Israel. So let me be clear about what I believe. I stand with Israel because of our shared values, which are so fundamental to the founding of both our nations. I believe the bonds between the United States and Israel are unbreakable, and we can never let anyone drive a wedge between us. Our bonds are rooted in our shared history and are strengthened by the ties between our peoples. And in the words of Shimon Peres, whose loss we mourn so deeply, for Israel's existence, we need the friendship of the United States of America. And of course, he knew that feeling goes both ways. And there's no question that friendship and our partnership must be unwavering. And I believe that Israel must be, the teleprompter has stopped, and now I'm going to catch it back up. There we are. I believe Israel should never be a partisan issue. And as long as I'm a United States Senator, I will do everything in my power to ensure broad and bipartisan support for Israel's security and right to self-defense. I believe that the only viable resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is two states for two people living side by side in peace and security. I believe that a resolution to this conflict cannot be imposed. It must be agreed upon by the parties themselves. Peace can only come through a reconciliation of differences, and that can only happen at the negotiating table. I believe that when any organization delegitimizes Israel, we must stand up and speak out for it to be treated equally. And that is why the first resolution I co-sponsored as a United States Senator was to combat anti-Israel bias at the United Nations and reaffirm that the United States seeks a just, secure, and sustainable two-state solution. And as someone who's personally prosecuted hate crime, I also believe that we cannot stand by while anti-Semitism, hate crime, and bigotry are on the rise, whether that's a swastika on a Jewish Family and Children's Services bus in San Francisco or the burning of a mosque in Tampa. That's why I am pleased to announce for the first time here at AIPAC that I'm introducing a Senate resolution that condemns targeting of Jews, as well as any form of religious bias, racism, misogyny, or other hateful acts targeting minorities across the United States. And let's be candid. Many, including those in this hall, have been directly impacted by the outrageous incidents targeting the Jewish community. This violence and hate is alarming and simply unacceptable. No one should have to worry about their children's safety when they drop them off at the JCC. No one should have to be afraid to put a menorah in their front window or on their front lawn. And no one should ever have to fear that the grave of a loved one might be desecrated because of their faith. So my resolution calls on law enforcement to expedite investigations of hate crime and hold perpetrators accountable. My resolution calls on law enforcement to fully report hate crime statistics. And my resolution calls on the administration to support victims and fund security at places of worship and other institutions that have been targeted of any faith. And as I fight to promote human rights and security, Israel and the Jewish community will always be a priority for me. And that is why, as Senator, I am particularly focused on three areas where I believe the United States and Israel can expand our cooperation and where California plays an important and central role. And the three are defense, cybersecurity, and water security. So, let's think about it. First, defense. In the midst of uncertainty and turmoil, America's support for Israel's security must be rock solid. And as Iran continues to launch ballistic missiles while it arms and funds its terrorist proxy Hezbollah, we must stand with Israel. As Hamas maintains its control of Gaza and fires rockets across Israel's southern border, we must stand with Israel. And as ISIS and civil war in Syria destabilize the region, displacing millions and threatening shared security interests, we must support all those affected by ongoing violence and terror, and we must stand with Israel. Our defense relationship is critical to both nations, which is why I support the United States' commitment to provide Israel with $38 billion in military assistance over the next decade. It is why I support full funding for Israel, including for the Arrow, David Sling, and the Iron Dome missile defense systems, which save lives. And that's why I am fully committing to maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge. At the same time, the United States must never permit Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. The Iran nuclear deal must be vigorously enforced through robust monitoring, inspection, and verification. And if Iran cheats, there's no question, Iran must be held accountable. And so as Iran inserts itself in Syria, including through the deployment of advanced military equipment and missiles that threaten Israel, we must not tolerate Iran fanning the flames of instability and violence in the region. In addition, Russia's explicit support for these actions is a direct threat to American interests, and it makes Israel less secure. So I say, the Trump administration must be crystal clear with Putin. Russia must stop. stop its support of Iran. This is a threat to the United States, and it is a threat to Israel. A second area where I believe we can expand our cooperation is cybersecurity and technology. As cyber attacks expose the vulnerabilities of our most essential systems and infrastructure, the United States and Israel must strengthen our innovation and technological capacities and our defenses together. Israel has more scientists and startups per capita than any other country in the world. And I'm proud that California, building on the 2014 commitments made by Prime Minister Liu and Governor Brown, has facilitated many of these technological partnerships and investments. Today, Tel Aviv and Silicon Valley are inextricably linked, ensuring that our two countries remain on the cutting edge. And when I met with Prime Minister Netanyahu last month, I was proud to discuss California's cyber advancements and the way we can expand those joint efforts. And the third area of growing cooperation is water security. So as any Californian in this hall can tell you, water is the lifeblood of our economies and our communities. And because of California's history of droughts, we know we cannot take water for granted. In this regard, we could not have a better example than Israel. Yes. Israel is a nation that is 60% desert, yet so water secure that it exports water to its neighbors. And Israel has been a great partner to California in this area. Take, for example, Carlsbad, California, where an Israeli company built a desalination plant which provides 50 million gallons of water to 400,000 Californians every day. So while the United States and Israel are geographically separated by water, we can also be bound by water. And I'm eager to champion these three partnerships in the Senate now and in the future, and to ensure that California plays a key role in the relationship between the United States and Israel. So in conclusion, AIPAC, we all know these are difficult times. I stand here clear-eyed about the dangers of division in our country and in our world, understanding why a state for the Jewish people is so essential. And I also stand here as someone with a lifelong commitment to justice, a lifelong faith in the power of democratic values and the innate oneness and goodness of human beings. And I believe that it's the common ground that unites so many of us. Values like faith, family, respect, and empathy that will see us through. Just look, for example, at the response when Jewish cemeteries in St. Louis and Philadelphia were so horribly, horribly vandalized. Muslim activists quickly raised money to restore the headstones, with one organizer posting on social media, quote, "I want to ask all Muslims to reach out to your Jewish brothers and sisters and stand together against this bigotry." Common ground. Look at the words of Elie Wiesel, who I knew personally and loved, when he said, "The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference." Common ground. Look at Israel's Supreme Court, that beautiful place I visited, upon which sits a Tunisian judge, alongside an Israeli Arab Christian and a Brooklyn-born Israeli, all presided over by a female Chief Justice. Common ground. Or look at my own life. Where a daughter of a South Asian mother and a Jamaican father concluded her own interfaith wedding with her husband, breaking a glass and everyone yelling Mazel Tov. So that's who we are. And if we embrace those values that have always made the United States and Israel great, then I believe our two nations will continue to move forward together for years and years to come. I thank you, AIPAC. Thank you.
And that was Kamala Harris speaking to AIPAC in 2017. Iraq is, by the way, AIPAC was recently rebuked in the Israeli press and told not to meddle in Israeli politics after it supported a statement by the American Jewish Committee criticizing Netanyahu for having welcomed into his coalition an ultra-right party calling itself Atzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power. This party is made up of devotees of the late racist rabbi Meir Kahane, who, as Israeli critics have compared to Nazis for their openly anti-Arab positions and actions which are similar to those of Hitler toward Jews. The American-born Kahane was the founder of the Jewish Defense League, which once was on the government's list of terrorist organizations, our government's list. In Israel, his Koch party and his offshoot Kahane Shai, which means Kahane lives, were outlawed in 1994, a month after Dr. Baruch Goldstein, an American-born Koch supporter, shot and killed 29 Palestinians as they were praying in the Hebron Mosque. Goldstein was overwhelmed and killed by the surviving worshippers, who were then banned from further prayer in the mosque. Goldstein remains a hero to the West Bank Jewish settlers who pay visits to Kiryat Arba, where he lived and where they built a monument to honor him. This is all by way of noting that for the first time in AIPAC's history, it has invited a settler, a senior leader of the Yesha Council, an umbrella organization of municipal councils of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, to speak at its annual convention. According to the Israel Hayom newspaper owned by Sheldon Adelson, AIPAC invited Oded Raveri, mayor of the illegal Efrat settlement and the Yesha Council's foreign envoy, to take part in a panel discussion on, quote, the future of Judea and Samaria, the names of Israelis and their supporters, and no one else called the Israeli-occupied West Bank of the Jordan River of historic Palestine. There's going to be another conference taking place that you're not going to hear about 2 days before the AIPAC conference in Washington, the sixth annual conference on American foreign policy in Israel, hosted by Institute for Research Middle East Policy and the Washington Report, which is where Gideon Levy, who I mentioned earlier, spoke in 2011. I have been speaking there at the time as well. You may hear more about that, but you won't. You could find it online. Go to IRMEP, IRMEP. .org, but you won't hear about it on or read about it in mainstream media. The time is now 11:58. We have a couple more minutes to go. Next Wednesday, Joy LeClaire returns at this time with Forthright Radio, when her guest will be Michael Kaufman, who for 3.5 decades has been a pioneer in engaging men to promote gender equality. Kaufman is the co-founder of the White Ribbon Campaign, the largest effort in the world of men to working to end violence against women. They'll be talking about his work and his book, The Time Has Come, Why Men Must Join the Gender Equality Revolution. And I'll be back with Takes on the World in 2 weeks. All of my programs, including this one for the past 90 days, can be found on KZYX's Jukebox. And for those before that, by doing a search for Jeff Blankford Radio, you can write me at jblankford@earthlink.net or at P.O. Box 548 in Ukiah 95482. Now, please stay tuned for Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Support for KZYX comes from our members in Tree of Life Charter School, a public Montessori elementary school in Ukiah. announcing open house on March 13th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Tree of Life Charter School is looking for families wishing to be part of a school community where school and home are interconnected and able to influence each other. Ages 5 through 13, information is at 462-0913 and www.treeoflifeschool.net. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening. Well, I'm not sure what happened to Kamala Harris there, but let's see if we get some more luck with Nikki Haley. This is Nikki Haley. We'll go back to Kamala Harris afterward, speaking last year to AIPAC, and I left in the applause because you could see how well-received she is.
About America's principled opposition to the Castro dictatorship in Cuba. The vote went against us, 191-2. The only two no votes, you guessed it, were the United States and Israel. But I always say, quality is more than quantity. Shortly after the 2016 election, President-elect Trump called me to talk about serving in his administration. We had a meeting at Trump Tower, and we had some good discussions about a variety of issues. Long story short, his team called me a couple of days later and said he'd like me to serve as ambassador to the United Nations. I said, I'm a governor. I don't know anything about the United Nations. We went back and forth on a few things, and the clincher was when I told the president, you know, I won't be a wallflower or a talking head. I have to be able to say what I think. Without any hesitation, President Trump said, Nikki, that's exactly why I want you to do this. President Trump has been true to his word, and I think I have too. Some of you might have seen that the top Palestinian negotiator, Saeb Erekat, recently had some advice for me. He told me to shut up. Mr. Erekat, I will always be respectful, but I will never shut up. When I spoke here last year, I had only been on the job a couple of months. Now it's a year later, and I know a lot more than I knew a year ago. But as I've learned more about how the UN operates, something else has become really clear. It is important to know as much as possible about every country's needs and views. But that's not the most important part of the job. The most important thing is to not be afraid to stick with the fundamental principles, even when they go against entrenched customs. Some of those outdated customs have gone unquestioned for years. Long before I got to the UN, I knew a few things that have served me well in this last year. One of those principles is that standing up for your friends is critical. So on my first day on the job, I chose to reach out to ambassadors from four countries. I called the British and French ambassadors because they are our closest allies on the Security Council. I called the ambassador from Ukraine because I wanted to reassure him that America would not waver in standing up for Ukraine against Russian aggression. And my fourth call on that first day was to Danny Danone, the Israeli ambassador. Just about a month before I arrived, the United States allowed Resolution 2334 to pass. It was a shameful day for America. We refused to stand up for our friend when it was singled out for terrible mistreatment. On my first day, I assured the Israeli ambassador that on my watch, that would never happen again. Principles I took with me into the job was that I have absolutely no patience for bullying. When I grew up, we were the only Indian family in a small southern town in South Carolina. On the whole, it was a great and friendly community. My parents and my brother and sister and I were always grateful for the support that surrounded us. But that didn't mean every day was great. My parents were immigrants. My father wore a turban. My mother wore a sari. There were times that we got bullied. When I was governor, I did something about it. I started an anti-bullying program. Every month I went to schools throughout the state to talk about bullying. For me, it was just so fundamental. You don't pick on someone just because they look different than you. You don't pick on someone just because they think differently than you. Or because you can. This idea has always been with me since I was a child, but I didn't. It turns out bullying is a common practice in the United Nations. In the real world, Israel is a strong country with a vibrant economy and a first-class military. On the battlefield, Israel does not get bullied. The Iranians and Syrians can vouch for that. But the UN is a different story. At the UN and throughout the UN agencies, Israel does get bullied. It gets bullied because the countries that don't like Israel are used to being able to get away with it. Well, just like when I was that little girl in South Carolina, that just doesn't sit well with me. As many of you know, one of the UN agencies with the worst track record of Israel bias is UNESCO. Among many other ridiculous things, UNESCO has the outrageous distinction of attempting to change ancient history. UNESCO recently declared one of Judaism's holiest sites, the Tomb of the Patriarchs, as a Palestinian heritage site in need of protection from Israel. That was enough. 10 months into this administration, the United States withdrew from UNESCO. That we do, big and small, week after week, to fight back against the UN's Israel bullying. Every month at the Security Council, we have a session devoted to the Middle East. And every month, this session becomes an Israel bashing session. This has gone on month after month for decades. This was news to me when I arrived. It was actually shocking. I came out of the first session and publicly said, if we want to talk about security in the Middle East, we should talk about Iran, or Syria, or Hezbollah, Hamas, ISIS, the famine in Yemen. There are probably 10 major problems in the Middle East, and Israel doesn't have anything to do with any of them. Just about every month since then in the Middle East session, I have spoken about something other than Israel. I can't say that we've solved the problem, but I can say that several other countries have followed our lead. What used to be a monthly Israel bashing session now at least has more balance. But we're never going to put up with bullying. There's one more principle I knew before I arrived at the UN. Like most Americans, I knew what the capital of Israel was. Jerusalem was, is, and will always be the capital of Israel. This is not something that was, I love you too. This was not something that was created by the location of an embassy. This is not something that was created by an American decision. America did not make Jerusalem Israel's capital. What President Trump did, to his great credit, was recognize a reality that American presidents had denied for too long. Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. That's a fact. And President Trump had the courage to recognize that fact when others would not. Sometime in the future, the day will come when the whole world recognizes that fact. In the meantime, I hope to be there and join our great ambassador, David Friedman. On the day when we open our brand new American embassy in Jerusalem. Embassy Kennedy decision caused a little bit of a stir at the United Nations. In the Security Council, almost exactly 1 year after the United States shamefully abstained when the Council attacked Israel with Resolution 2334, I had the great honor of casting my first American veto. When I was governor, I used my veto power dozens of times. At the UN, I never got to do it until the Jerusalem vote. I gotta say, it felt pretty good. The next week, the Jerusalem issue was brought before the UN General Assembly. We lost that vote. But to many people's surprise, 65 countries refused to go against us. In the long history of UN's mistreatment of Israel, that's quite a record. And we're not forgetting that vote. Like I said at that time, on that vote, we were taking names. Last week, I took a trip to Guatemala and Honduras. And I thank them both for voting with us. God bless Guatemala. They even joined us in moving their embassy to Jerusalem. And President Trump and I are pushing to draw a closer connection between U.S. foreign aid and how countries vote at the U.N. UN votes should never be the only factor in our foreign aid decisions. We have many interests that go beyond the UN, but they should be one of the factors, and we are determined to start making that connection. Some people accuse us of favoritism towards Israel. First of all, there's nothing wrong with showing favoritism toward an ally. That's what being an ally is all about. But this is really not about favoritism. In all that we're doing, whether it's the embassy decision or UNESCO or what we're doing with UNRWA, don't even get me started on that one. Our approach on Israel is tied together by one major idea. The idea that runs through all of it is the simple concept that Israel must be treated like any other normal country. We will continue to demand that Israel not be treated like some sort of temporary provisional entity. It cannot be the case that only one country in the world doesn't get to choose its capital city. It cannot be the case that the UN Human Rights Council has a standing agenda item for only one country. It cannot be the case that only one set of refugees throughout the world is counted in a way that causes the number to grow forever. It cannot be the case that in an organization with 193 countries, a nation spends half of its time attacking only one country. We will not accept it any longer.
Okay, you have heard almost all of... I got two calls while I was playing Nikki Haley, one from a listener who was disgusted to hear her speech, calling it Israeli propaganda, and I explained why I was playing it, because you won't hear this anywhere else. And another caller was saying I had no business playing it, and Americans don't need to hear this. I respectfully disagree, and I'm preoccupied with the subject, as many of you know, because it is censored in our media. It is never discussed on MSNBC. It's not discussed on NPR. It's not discussed sometimes on Democracy Now. But for me, I think it's very important, because we got into a war in Iraq because certain neocons were invited into the White House and orchestrated the false information that led us into that war in Iraq. I think it's important to talk about. By the way, AIPAC was recently rebuked in the Israeli press and told not to meddle in Israeli politics after it supported a statement by the American Jewish Committee criticizing Netanyahu for having welcomed into his coalition an ultra-right party calling itself Atzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power. This party is made up of devotees of the late racist rabbi Meir Kahane, who, as Israeli critics have compared to Nazis for their openly anti-Arab positions and actions which are similar to those of Hitler toward Jews. The American-born Kahane was the founder of the Jewish Defense League, which once was on the government's list of terrorist organizations, our government's list. In Israel, his Koch party and his offshoot Kahane Chai, which means Kahane lives, Chai, were outlawed in 1994, a month after Dr. Baruch Goldstein, an American-born Koch supporter, shot and killed 29 Palestinians as they were praying in the Hebron Mosque. Goldstein was overwhelmed and killed by the surviving worshippers, who were then banned from further prayer in the mosque. Goldstein remains a hero to the West Bank Jewish settlers who pay visits to Kiryat Arba, where he lived and where they built a monument to honor him. This is all by way of noting that for the first time in AIPAC's history, it has invited a settler, a senior leader of the Yesha Council, an umbrella organization of municipal councils of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, to speak at its annual convention. According to the Israel Hayom newspaper owned by Sheldon Adelson, AIPAC invited Oded Ravevi, mayor of the illegal Efrat settlement and the Yesha Council's foreign envoy, to take part in a panel discussion on, quote, the future of Judea and Samaria, the names of Israelis and their supporters, and no one else called the Israeli-occupied West Bank of the Jordan River of historic Palestine. There's going to be another conference taking place that you're not going to hear about 2 days before the AIPAC conference in Washington, the sixth annual conference on American foreign policy in Israel, hosted by Institute for Research Middle East Policy and the Washington Report, which is where Gideon Levy, who I mentioned earlier, spoke in 2011. I have been speaking there at the time as well. You can find that online. Go to IRMEP, I-R-M-E-P, .org, but you won't hear about it on or read about it in mainstream media. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.